Let me start out and ask you if you could give us a brief bio of yourself.
Okay, I'm a professor of history at York University in Toronto. I have sort of spent most of my life working on the history of modern war, modern total war, written a book on the American Civil War and the origins of modern war, and, of course, this book on U.S. biological warfare policy in the early Cold War period. I'm a Canadian who went to graduate school in the States, taught at Ohio State University for some time, and before transferring to York University in 1970. And that's about all the relevant stuff that I can think of.
Okay, and what originally motivated you to write your book?
Well, I came out of that perspective of someone who's interested in the history of modern total war. And I worked in the Civil War for the reason that was, as far as I'm concerned, the first modern total war. And I've spent a fair chunk of my life sort of developing that theme and that thesis. And I became interested in U.S. biological warfare policy in the early Cold War for the reason that it looked like sort of the most interesting extension of the extension of the limits of total war in the post-World War II period. When you move into biological warfare policy, you're moving into certain sacrosanct areas where military policy had been reluctant sort of to tread sort of beyond sort of a preliminary, you might say, experimental phase. And where you're treading, of course, is into medical science and the implications of the Hippocratic Oath. And this is not another science like physics or chemistry, which has always been used in warfare. This is using medical science to kill. And there's a general consensus out there in American society and in Western society that this is not a good idea. So you're treading in troubled waters, which is one of the reasons this program is so secret. During this period, this is sort of a case study of how, in a period of crisis, I believe, there's a tendency to sort of move toward the extremes of survival. And the extreme here is that the United States and Britain and Canada, who are part of this tripartite program, with the United States really leading the way, decided in the post-World War II period that this was perhaps the window, the edge that would enable them to win a total war against the Soviet Union. It would be perhaps decisive. And for that reason, it was worth taking this risk. Now, the United States builds this into its military doctrine and into its strategy. Now, there have been other biological warfare programs, and the Japanese were into this first. The Japanese used it in China. But it was an experimental program. As far as we know, they did not reach that state where they built it into military doctrine. The experiments where they used it against the Chinese were done by a squadron that was attached to the biological warfare unit in Manchuria. So the American extension of biological warfare during this period was a first, and it was, I think, a major sort of transition in extending the limits of war.
How did the U.S. biological weapons program get started?
Well, the United States was rather slow to get started, really, and they did not really wind up their program and get seriously involved until the beginning of World War II. And part of the reason for that was that the internal appraisal was that biological weapons were not feasible. But then they began to see that other countries were developing biological weapons programs. They began to get word that the Japanese were fairly far along, and also the internal evaluations began to change with respect to the possibilities of biological weapons. So during World War II, they set up a major program. They had over 4,000 people working in the program by the end of the war, and it was the second largest scientific project during World War II, the largest project after the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb. After the war, there was a general consensus on the part of everybody in the tripartite program, the Americans, British, the Canadians, that biological weapons had tremendous potential, perhaps more potential as a weapon of mass destruction than the atomic bomb. And it was also more flexible, could be used in conventional strategic ways, could be used tactically, and they emphasized that it had tremendous potential as a covert weapon. The British and the Americans were also very concerned about efforts to limit weapons of mass destruction within the United Nations after the war. And well, the bottom line is they thought they were going to be able to do it, if this happened, they'd be able to do an end run with biological weapons, which they were arguing publicly were not weapons of mass destruction. For the reason there's no scientific proof that they could function as weapons of mass production. At the same time, they're arguing sort of in policy circles and in scientific circles that, in fact, they had tremendous potential as weapons of mass destruction. There were quite a few reasons why the biological weapons were very attractive. They're cheap compared to atomic weapons. And this was important in the post-World War II budget debates where there was not much military budget. They also emphasized that they destroyed people, not property, and that was uppermost in the minds of the American military and civilians at this time because of the tremendous costs of reconstructing Europe and Japan. The moral issue around the Hippocratic Oath, for example, it just doesn't come up. It's evaded. There is no discussion of it in policy circles as far as we could find. And the ethical debate around the issue is clipped. You almost begin to get the sense that a position was adopted and you just sort of plug it in wherever it's relevant. And the position was that growing out of World War II, war is total war. Weapons are not relevant. How you die is not an issue. And there are even arguments that biological weapons are more humane than other forms of weapons. So this all gels. Now, as a result of this, the United States secretly, between 50 and 53, launched a very large-scale crash program on biological weapons, put a lot of money into it. And the United States still does not affirm that this happened. They don't deny it. They just don't talk about it. At the same time, they built it into military doctrine. They built it into the emergency plan for general war against the Soviet Union after 49 against China. So it is becoming an integral part, really, of the American military system. They also develop a first-use policy, which they deny, except that the documentation is sitting there to be read, as is the documentation on the crash program, which is piled, a mile deep. Now, if you go through sort of the documentation of policymaking during this period, you get a very pessimistic point of view with respect to the possibilities of avoiding war. There's that sense that a general war is going to come, and biological weapons consequently begin to occupy a more prominent place as the possible difference. Now, along comes the Korean War, which is sort of a controversial part of all of this. Now, the Chinese documents, which we had access to, more accurately, my co-author Stephen Endicott managed to acquire access to in his capacity as a historian of China with some very good connections. From the Chinese side, out of the documents, out of their archives, there's a concrete case that the United States used biological weapons. And out of the U.S. archives, Canadian archives, and Australian sources, there is sort of a pile of circumstantial evidence that supports the Chinese documentation. And we put that together. This, of course, is very controversial and is hotly denied. And most of the attention around the book, of course, has been around the charges of use in Korea. Now, from my perspective, that's, in many ways, the least interesting part of what happened. Historically speaking, biological weapons have been used in war before. So in terms of the evolution of warfare, it's not new. In terms of the United States, it is obviously a black eye, I've affirmed. But I think it's probably far more important that the history of biological weapons during this time sees biological weapons integrated into U.S. military doctrine, into first-use policy subject to presidential approval, same policy as atomic warfare, and that the United States intended to use these weapons if general war broke out. There was an interesting order which went out from the Secretary of Defense at the beginning of the crash program, which said to develop doctrine and research and development together. Don't let one follow the other. The normal pattern would be to develop your weapons, test them, and then standardize them and integrate them into into a strategy which would not be developed until the research and development phase was concluded. But the orders here was to let it advance together. And what they were trying to do was to get whatever they could of a biological weapons system into place as rapidly as possible in case war broke out tomorrow. At the same time, they had long-term plans for a standardized system. The first deadline was July 1st, 1954. With respect to what happened in Korea, the history there is, from the Chinese side, is a history that we looked at from the Chinese medical records. And we looked at from the dialogue that was going on between the top leadership in China, top political and military leadership, political cadre in the field, and with the public health officials, the medical teams who were looking at this. And the medical teams were highly skilled teams, almost always led by Western-educated scientists. A tremendous number of Western-educated scientists were involved in the investigation of the biological warfare charges. And what you see is sort of a careful, meticulous attempt to put together some idea of what's going on. There's skepticism, there's looking around for anomalous patterns and so on. And it's an area where the Chinese are highly competent because epidemiology is an area which they have a high level of expertise, in which the Chinese medical universities, which are almost all established by Westerners, attached to sort of Western organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation and so on, produce very good medical scientists. So we were looking at that evidence, and they were finding sort of evidence in particular of anthrax, plague, and encephalitis. Now, when you look at the debate that's going on politically, the debate that's going on among the Chinese leadership, there are a couple of interesting points. One, this is top secret stuff that we were given out of the archives, which was never part of the debate at the time. It's not been made accessible to scholars other than Chinese scholars, and not the most Chinese scholars, if any, so far as we can determine. And it shows hesitation, shows that the leadership is sort of incredulous that this might be happening. But at the same time, the reports keep coming in. And Mao puts Alan Lai in charge of sort of the investigation. And you see this dialogue going back and forth. And Mao is finally convinced by data that comes out of one of the Chinese army groups that's in Korea. And from there on, you begin to get just the putting together of an increasing pile of medical evidence and evidence of tracking of American planes coming in and so on and so forth. The second interesting thing about this debate is that since it's in top secret channels, the highest secret channels that Chinese have, this data wouldn't exist if this was a put-up job. It wouldn't exist for the reason that, you know, the internal apparatus is hardly going to propagandize itself. And we sort of think that that is just an important consideration to bear in mind. There's interesting episodes sort of on the ground in the Korean War, and the episodes have to be put in the context of really the infrastructure for biological warfare that was available for Korea. I think probably the most interesting and surprising discovery we made was we found the infrastructure for covert biological warfare. It was buried deeply in the Psychological Warfare Division of the United States Air Force. Now, it turns out that this group, at the beginning of the war, were responsible for all biological warfare plans and operations. As the war went on, plans and operations, the Air Force headquarters took some of this back, but they remained responsible for covert. And it also indicated that they had air arms, or at least the time they had one air arm up and running, an ARC wing, the famous ARC wing, which is Air Resupplying Communications, part of the Military Air Transport Service. But in fact, it was an air wing for covert activity, and it was, again, under the command of the Psychological Warfare Division. Now, at the same time, we began to put together sort of the infrastructure by which the Psychological Warfare Division had close ties with the CIA, and with the United States Air Force. The CIA is people who would be operational people on the ground or in the air, and the U.S. Air Force, who had the capability to run covert missions with airplanes. Now, this is sort of a complicated story, but probably the best way to get at it is that the critical link was the Air Force Chief of Staff, Hoyt Vandenberg. Vandenberg had a long history in intelligence, a long history with the CIA. Truman appointed Vandenberg to take the OSS and convert it into a modern intelligence service. This was one of his first assignments when he was a young general in the post-World War II period, and Vandenberg very quickly sort of put that all in order and created what was then the Central Intelligence Service, which had become the CIA. He was then put in charge of reconstructing military intelligence to make it a modern intelligence system, which he did. And Vandenberg believed that the Psychological Warfare Division, as a covert division, should have major status in military organization. Vandenberg believed it should have command status, same status as the Tactical Air Command or the Strategic Air Command. He was a strong believer in covert war. And he was a strong believer in integrating covert operations and overt operations, or more accurately, I suppose, covert and overt operators. And you have this tremendous traffic of people who are CIA, a CIA assignment, flying with U.S. Air Force, and U.S. Air Force officers who were flying on temporary assignment, the CIA. It's so extreme you even have CIA officers who are flying conventional Air Force missions. It becomes very much an integrated mishmash, sort of during the Korean War. And through this link between the Psychological Warfare Division, charge of biological warfare, the CIA, and the Air Force, you have an infrastructure for covert war. How did it play out? As you start trying to look for stuff that's happening on the ground, there are two instances of where our research led us into areas which are truly tantalizing. One instance had to do with some operations orders for the 3rd Bomb Wing. Now, operations orders are rare things. Mission reports, more common, to find operations orders for units. Very, very difficult. As far as we can determine, most of them, as far as they exist, are buried away in the Air Force Record Center in St. Louis. There's an enormous amount of stuff there, which some of which is just lost for reasons I wouldn't get into. You just can't get the stuff out. Not to try and necessarily hide it. It needs to be inventoried, and they've lost track of it. They don't know what's in all those boxes, for example. Anyway, we found one batch of operations orders for the 3rd Bomb Wing, and it showed a peculiar pattern. The pattern was one where the Air Force was bombing enemy communications, roads, trucks, rail lines, bridges, and so on. And it showed that during the day, fighter bombers were coming over and bombing rail lines and bridges. And at night, B-26s came over and dumped their loads. And the last four planes that came over every night dropped a couple of leaflet bombs. Now, whenever you see leaflet bombs, you sort of have to take a closer look, because the leaflet bomb was converted into a biological bomb. It was the first standardized biological bomb, and it was the most effective one insofar as it was a good bomb. The Air Force was happy with this bomb. It's initially developed as an anti-crop weapon, but there's evidence that it was also being developed to be used as an anti-personnel weapon against transportation lines and against concentrations of sort of in the field, but it's looked upon as a very effective weapon against transportation. And the bomb that was identified in these operational orders was the M105, which is also the bomb that the Chinese identify as a biological bomb. Now, this pattern of dropping biological bombs at the end of bomb runs corresponds to one of the confessions of one of the flyers who was shot down and as a prisoner of war confessed to being involved in a biological warfare campaign. Now, these confessions, of course, were retracted under threat of court-martial, but nevertheless, the stories gel. The story gels with, I should say, the data out here. Now, when those confessions were published, the U.S. Air Force launched a general investigation. And as they acknowledged up front, it wasn't an attempt to take a balanced look. It was an attempt to make the Air Force's case they were not involved with biological warfare. And this was conducted by the Office of Special Investigations in the Air Force. And they brought before it the commander of the 3rd Bomb Wing to answer questions about these leaflet bombs. And his answer was, well, this was standard operating procedure. We drop leaflet bombs at the end of the bomb runs each day to warn people about subsequent bombing runs the following days so they can get out of the way. Now, you ask yourself some questions. There's a humanitarian motive when they drop the leaflet bombs in the morning before they bombed blazes out of this place all day. Also, there are thousands of aircraft up there. They're doing nothing but dropping leaflet bombs. Millions of leaflets, not millions of bombs, but millions of leaflets being strewn all over the place. So why have these handful of leaflet bombs at the end? Well, they still say standard operating procedure. And it seems that to a degree it may have been. But, flaw in the case, the sequence of bombing along that rail cut was such that there wouldn't be any further bombings until several weeks later, which would make dropping any leaflet bombs sort of useless. The standard operating procedure sort of so ingrained and so dumb that these were actually leaflet bombs. Well, that's where it sits. You have to sort of leave it at that, but there is a piece of data. Interesting case number two in terms of what was, may have been going on at the ground, and this is sort of a policy one, sort of a complicated little maze way. The White House sets up an organization known as the Psychological Strategy Board. And the Psychological Strategy Board is set up in 1952 to become involved, among other things, in covert warfare. Now, there's a political battle going on here over who's going to control covert warfare in the field, which I won't get into, but it's a little bit too complicated, I think, to relay at this time. But the bottom line is, this may have been a case of the White House trying to come in and assert its authority over covert warfare in the field. They may have been running interference for the Army, which had been sort of cut out of this by everybody else. The people in the field, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, CIA, Far East Command, don't buy it and tell the White House to butt out. Nevertheless, the Psychological Strategy Board continues to put together covert plans, covert operational plans, to be implemented by the agencies in the field, the services, CIA, and so on. One of these plans is a plan called Operation Takeoff, a code name later changed to Operation Broadbrim. This was a covert plan that was to go into effect if the armistice negotiations failed or broke down, and of course they did. And there's an interesting track through the policy papers which indicate that this plan was implemented, but amidst a great deal of debate, and the debate was going on between the Secretary of Defense, the Army, and the Psychological Strategy Board. The Army and the Secretary of Defense were nervous about this plan. The Psychological Strategy Board was pushing it. And the Psychological Strategy Board, which had a lot of power, because it had presidential authority behind it, does prevail. And it appears that this plan went into place. Now, there's also evidence that this plan included novel weapons. Now, novel weapons in the nomenclature include biological, chemical, and radiological. Radiological in the sense of weapons that are not bombs, but are the spreading of radiological belts from current nomenclature, dirty bombs. Now, working with radiological weapons had been put on hold by Marshall, and when he made his recommendations in the so-called Stevenson Report, which really becomes the policy framework for development in novel weapons from 1950 to 1953, radiological weapons were put on hold. Chemical weapons were downgraded, and biological weapons were given top priority, the same priority as atomic weapons. So we're going to talk about novel weapons here. You can presume that they were probably talking about biological weapons. That is a reasonable assumption. Some quirk it may not have been, but it's a reasonable assumption based upon sort of the logic of what's going on here in policy circles. The Army representative for these meetings does not want to pass on this plan to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But he's pushed hard, and he does. And the plan appears to be implemented. Now, in this sequence, as you go through the timing of these discussions, three colonels are sent on a mission to General Ridgway's headquarters in Tokyo. What was that mission? Were those three colonels carrying Operation Broadbrim to Ridgway? Well, you go through the documents around these three colonels, and it turns out that one thing they were doing was carrying information to Ridgway on a simulated atomic attack on the enemy trenches. Ridgway seemed very frustrated with his inability to penetrate them and began to talk about tactical atomic weapons. So they ran a simulation, and these colonels were, among other things, taking the word to Ridgway that the evaluation was negative. But one of the colonels refers to taking another weapon for Ridgway to use, and Ridgway isn't going to like it. Well, that's not atomic weapons. Ridgway loves atomic weapons. Or these biological weapons. Next part of the story. One of the confessions of the flyers who shot down, Colonel Andrew Evans, begins to dovetail in here. Evans gives a very long, intricate sort of confession. And Evans served on the War Plans Division, in the War Plans Division of Air Force Headquarters prior to going to Korea. Evans's confession says that the biological weapons campaign was introduced into Korea by, how do you put it, by hand. It was delivered to Ridgway by hand, I believe he put it, something to that effect. So there's the dovetail. Again, it's just sort of this tantalizing circumstantial stuff that piles up. Was this the planning venue, the implementation venue that really introduced biological weapons into the Korean War? Well, concretely, can't really say, but the circumstantial evidence is tantalizing, and so much fits that you have to put it down, you have to put it on paper and say, okay, it is there, and I'll do with it what you will. At the time that the United States was denying the charges, the United States was also agitating to have the Chinese agree to have probably the International Red Cross come in to investigate these charges. A body that, you know, has certain suspicions around it with respect to what was going on in World War II, suspicions subsequently confirmed. And the Chinese basically did not want to have very much to do with him for various reasons. But the Defense Department tells Ridgway at this time, should the International Committee of the Red Cross come in to investigate biological weapons, you have authority to deny them any sensitive information. It's sitting right there. At the same time, the Defense Department is telling the ambassador to the United Nations, their ambassador to disarmament talks, that you may not say that the United States will not use biological weapons, and dash, even in Korea, dash, under any circumstances. Meanwhile, of course, the ambassador of the UN is simply chastising the Chinese for not allowing the International Committee of the Red Cross to come in, not allowing observers really picked by the United States and by the United Nations who are fighting the war against them to come in, and claiming that the United States is open and free and there are no secrets. So that was one little incident in the policy, in the internal apparatus of the policy discussions. Another one had to do with where we get into the Canadian archives. When we get into the Canadian archives, which opened up when we were almost at the end of the book, we call up the archivist to see what was available at the time, and the archivist told us, well, it's all closed except for this, this, and this, and she brings it up on the screen and says, my God, it's all open. So we get in. We got to look at a lot of stuff. And one of the most interesting things that came out of this had to do with the U.S. denial of Chinese charges, which tend to be based upon the use of insect vectors to deliver disease, And they sort of poo-pooed this as being, you know, crazy stuff. And they, there's a group of American scientists, three scientists, who made a report which was run in the New York Times. Got a lot of attention. But they also came to the Canadian government, sort of secretly, and asked the Canadian Department of External Affairs, asked them to put some scientists on this to make a report. So this Department of External Affairs appointed three scientists who did a report and, again, pretty much followed the lead of the Americans and sort of wrote it off as ridiculous. However, what the documents in the Canadian archives reveal is that the Canadian Minister of External Affairs, Lester Pearson, Nobel Prize winner, all that sort of thing, later Prime Minister, sent the data that was provided by the Chinese and North Koreans, sent that data to the head of the Canadian Biological Warfare Laboratories, Wilford B. Reed, a famous scientist and the expert in the tripartite program, or rather the ranking expert in the program, on insect vectors. Been working on them since before World War II. The Canadians get into biological warfare for Americans. And Reed was doing a very advanced work in insect vectors. And Reed sends back to Pearson a note to the effect that the reports are feasible, and advised him not to get involved in the scientific aspects of the debate. And that report is stamped, seen by the Minister of External Affairs. And that report remained a secret document until about 1996 or 7, I guess, when it was finally declassified. So there's a tantalizing trail of what was going on behind the scenes versus what was being put on the public record.
Talk, if you would, about that the U.S. biological program couldn't have achieved what it did without help from industry and universities.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biological warfare program, the bottom line is, could not have functioned without the cooperation of the medical community. All those people with MDs after their names was taking the Hippocratic Oath. And the disease people working in conjunction with their organization industrially, and their organization in public health institutions, and their organization within the military, Camp Detrick, and so on, who really created the biological warfare program, which is why it is in many ways a not only an ethical issue, but an interesting historical issue with respect to extending the limits of warfare into the one sacrosanct area of science that until that time had arguably been kept out of warfare, or at least out of a systematic development of weapon systems. When you take a look at the network, which we sort of try to put together, everybody's involved out there. They push into every corner where they can find anybody to assist, and people certainly come to the trough, and some of the scientists who talk about it in retrospect said, well, hey, it seemed the thing to do at the time. There was a greater morality, the morality of defeating communism, just like the morality of defeating fascism before, they say. So you turn on blinders and say, this is the greater morality. But there's some interesting rationales out there. The medical community is still involved in biological warfare, up to his ears.
I found it interesting that George Merck, mm-hmm. the founder of Merck Pharmaceuticals, was one of the lead people early on.
Oh, yeah, Merck was instrumental in organizing the initial biological warfare effort in the Second World War, because the first level of organization was to organize industry, and Merck did that. And then the military was being organized around Camp Detrick. And eventually the military would take over the civilian sector, but Merck was instrumental in really setting it up. And after the war, leading into the Korean War, he remains an advisor to the War Department and Defense Department. And his role is to sort of try to propagandize and to, again, try to, I think, bring together the same coalitions that were involved in the Second World War. So he was a prime player, yeah, certainly was.
And I also understand that the U.S. biowarfare program got a big, pardon the pun, shot in the arm from the captured Japanese information. They had a big biowarfare program. In fact, I believe the largest in World War II.
Yeah, the one extraordinarily controversial area where the evidence is in and the acknowledgments have been made, and that is that the United States took over the Japanese biological warfare program after the war and sort of made a deal with the devil. And the deal with the devil was the Japanese had, of course, experimented with human subjects. And, so far as it's been put together to date, it's managed to slaughter at least 10,000 of them, probably more. And at the end of the war, the Japanese biological warfare scientists and participants in the program were up in the dock as Class A war criminals until it was decided, as a result of a collusion of just about everybody in the military and the civilian sector of government, that they had valuable information and it was necessary to get hold of that information. They needed the result of the research and development with live subjects for the American Biological Warfare Program. And they were given immunity. They were given immunity and they were integrated back into Japanese society, back into Japanese science, university culture, continued to play critical roles in that world until, for the most part, until they retired or died. What they get out of the program, they got something out of the program. Mostly, they confirmed some of the stuff they're doing. By the end of the Second World War, the American program was a larger, more sophisticated program, for the most part, than the Japanese. But they were able to sort of run a check, and they were able to take a look at the Japanese data and see whether or not this sort of corresponded with their own experience, their own experiments. But there is evidence that they did benefit in some areas, which we sort of note in the book, and they learned something. Now there's been an attempt to sort of effort to poo-poo what they learned, saying we knew all this stuff. But at the time, the documents indicated that, hey, we were learning stuff about this and that and one thing and another from the Japanese evidence. Yes, it's a grim story, and it's, again, it's a story of military expediency. It's that issue of what people will do in times of perceived crisis. And in a time of perceived crisis, the highest morality is to protect your national sovereignty. It's more or less the way the political theoretical thinking goes. And whatever you have to do to protect the national sovereignty prevails over any other morality. And that's always the argument that's put on the table. It's the argument, that George Bush has at least had the, or W. Bush, the current, has had the honesty to put on the table, because others have been practicing it as he walked away from international agreements, walked away from international laws, saying that we will not participate, this government will not participate in any actions that do not protect the national sovereignty of the United States. And that's always been the argument against the morality of, as say, encoded in international law, including the Charter of the United Nations, that national sovereignty prevails. Convenient argument, and one that sort of turns the whole world of international law, international morality, sort of into a, I don't know what to call it, cesspool.
So do you see, as a historian, do you see a lot of parallels between the current world situation with the United States threatening to attack Iraq or upgrade its attack on Iraq and what you have discovered about the U.S. program in Korea?
Well, that can be answered broadly or can be answered narrowly in a number of directions. Let me focus on an area which is a little more within my expertise and to a degree involvement, and that is that attempt to extend the U.S. Biological Warfare Convention of 1972. The signatories agreed not to develop biological weapons. Through the 1990s, there was sort of a continuing effort to put together an extension of that agreement to give it some teeth, to give it some sort of verification procedure, process, that you could take seriously. The problem in this debate from the beginning was there were sort of two agendas. One agenda was that of the United States and its allies. Well, there's some of the allies were even lukewarm in this. There was somewhat of a breaking of the ranks, you know, within NATO, at least behind the scenes in policy give and take. The only really, I think, truly loyal ally of the United States on this was probably Britain at that time. The United States wanted an agenda in place whereby they would essentially be allowed to determine who would have the right to have biological weapons and who would not. They would have the right to determine who was dangerous and who was not. This, of course, sounds very familiar. And they demanded an inspection regimen, protocol, and so on and so forth. It was very rigid on others. At the same time, they wished to basically exempt themselves or put qualifications on just how exposed they were willing to leave their pharmaceutical industry, which meant that essentially we're not going to be inspected. The non-Western world, with some support in the Western world, is saying that that is not the agenda that we're going to accept. We want an agenda that recognizes legitimate security concerns throughout the world. There are regional security concerns, there are local security concerns. Different people have to be concerned about their own self-defense. And, say, the Indian representatives would argue that they have real concerns vis-a-vis Pakistan, real concerns vis-a-vis China, and they must be concerned with that, and so on and so forth. Also, in return for putting their weapons of mass destruction on the table, biological and chemical, they wanted the United States to put their weapons of mass destruction on the table, namely nuclear weapons, since the United States had agreed in 1972 that they were going to withdraw from biological weapons. And the United States, of course, refused to do this. Now, here they got a lot of opposition. There was even a break in the rank of NATO, which never was really put on the table officially, but there was a break in the ranks led by Canada, actually, whereby when the vote came in the United Nations on putting their weapons, nuclear weapons, on the table, members of NATO other than Great Britain just absented themselves from the vote, didn't vote against it, but they absented themselves from the vote. And here you see the end of this story is, of course, that Bush, very shortly after coming to power, indicated that the United States was going to withdraw from the discussions around the Biological Warfare Treaty, again on the argument that it was not in the national interest to pursue it. And what was going on here, of course, was that the debate just was mired from the beginning in these two agendas. I was involved in this in a peripheral way. I was invited to a conference in Geneva to discuss these issues around this attempt to extend the Biological Warfare Treaty. In fact, we were in the Palais de Nation, the old League of Nations buildings, now UN buildings, in a room, I believe, next door to where the treaty discussions were going on. And they took a holiday and came in and joined our conference and participated in our discussions to a degree. So I sort of saw that unfold sort of on the ground to a degree. And you looked at that, and in many ways it was sort of a microcosm of the larger debate with respect to that dialogue between foreign and military policy.
So it does seem that there seems to be an arrangement now, and it sounds like there always was an arrangement between the different nations that participate in this biological chemical warfare programs and protecting the industries, in this case the pharmaceutical companies, that are the backbone of those programs.
Yeah, there's tremendous concern in the pharmaceutical industry that their secrets not be exposed, that inspection not be allowed. And this is particularly heated coming out of the United States and out of Great Britain. And I saw a lot of that going on. And there are some other players. India is a large pharmaceutical industry, and they don't want their pharmaceutical industry exposed either, despite the fact that they're on the other side of this debate when it comes to a biological warfare agenda. So they sort of have to, play a double game out there in terms of the debate going on.
So supposedly the offensive part of the U.S. biological warfare program was shut down, but based on what you've researched, do you A, actually believe that, and B, it looks like it might very well be getting fired up again here soon, at least if our current administration here mm-hmm. gets to keep going in the direction it wants to.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot of room under defensive biological warfare to, in fact, do offensive things. And the way that the program has gone on is very much we need to develop offensive weapons. We need to understand how they work in terms of research and development in order to defend against them. And that issue has been made public, and there have been developments that have been made public which indicates that the United States really is walking a very, very tight line between offensive and defensive research. You know, it's a dangerous area. With the United States perhaps on the verge of getting back into an official declaration of being involved in offensive biological warfare, I wouldn't rule it out, certainly. The current mood in the United States, I think there's a tremendous range of the hardliners, obviously, to push for extreme military policies.
What haven't we covered here that you feel is important to get out to our listeners?
Well, I think the message, you know, that I would like to get out, I guess, is the professorial message. People should try to acquire some basic understanding of what is going on out there. And that is difficult to do, I confess, because there's so much spin being put upon everything. And so much misinformation being sort of spewed out. It is really tough to sift out what is real and what is not real about issues with respect to biological warfare, with respect to the capabilities of this country and that country, and also issues with respect to motive and so on. And issues with respect to the implications of military acts. My concern, which I think should be a concern of everybody, is that fear of what happens when you get into a situation where people begin to fear for their own personal security. And that's an atmosphere which history tends to tell us leads to the moderate center collapsing and people moving to extremes. And hey, look at the United States at the moment. Look at what's happened in Israel and the Palestinian territories. And look at many other situations that have just deteriorated into a world where there is no middle. They're just sort of extremes which lead to military solutions as the only solutions. And that is not a good idea, particularly with the weapons that are currently available, with the possibilities of actions escalating, possibilities of how the whole Middle East could, say, come unstuck around, say, an attack on Iraq. The implications of this are just so extraordinary with respect to Kurds, Shiites, Iran, Turkey, and so on, as well as Israel, that it's really an incredible gamble. And to take it, you're either very short-sighted or you don't care about the consequences and are willing to go out there and engage in sort of what becomes almost endless war. Worrisome stuff. At least I worry about it.
I think a lot of us worry about it. It seems these military solutions come from the fact that, at least here in the U.S., we've allowed the military and its contractors to run our policies.
Mm-hmm. I've worked in do some work in the history of U.S. militarism, U.S. culture, and I tend to see the real villains being the politicians. The politicians who are willing to follow tendencies within, if you want, the political arena, and tend to follow tremendous pressures, society that can be both highly nationalistic and somewhat paranoid at a time when it feels its security is threatened. The more so when personal security is threatened, which is what's become involved with the events since September 11th. And that's the group I worry about. The contractors are people out there who are trying to push their interests, and there's no question, I think, at the moment that oil interests play a rather large role in this administration. You know, after all, the Middle East, ultimately, I think, maybe about oil, but all of a sudden it's becoming about other things. Corporate interests in general at the moment certainly are big interests, and that gets tied into the ideology of globalization. And globalization is an ideology that, you know, is basically an American creation, I think, that could not survive as an ideology, nor could it survive structurally without United States support. But ultimately, those are political decisions. That's a political agenda that's been put into place, which is, I agree with you to a degree, being taken over by people who come out of a world that is predominantly that of, at the moment, predominantly that of business, predominantly that of specific areas of business, areas that benefit from an internationalization, a globalization, and areas that tend to be overly involved, perhaps with oil.
I neglected to ask you how you obtained the documents and what you had to go through to get the information that you used to base your book on.
Well, the documents that come out of the United States and Canada, it's a matter of just going in there and looking for them and making a whole lot of requests for declassification under the Freedom of Information Act. And then when it gets denied, sort of follow up the appeals and hope that some stuff comes loose. And every now and again, some very good stuff came loose. Chinese materials, well, my co-author had very good contacts in China, in part through the work of his father, but also his own contacts. And he was able to persuade the Chinese government to allow us to go into the archives, and the archivists were very cooperative and helpful. So that's how we get into the Chinese archives.
But you report now they're closing down, not on the Chinese side, but on the U.S. side, they're closing down access to these type of documents.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Well, it's in the current atmosphere as we expected. Unfortunately, I think our book may have contributed to closing some stuff down. There's one other little sort of bit of evidence that I didn't bring up. That's a bit of Australia that I noticed. I didn't come back to it. This interesting third-hand witness that went on, and everybody ignores it. Yet he's out there, and we weren't the first to get to him. A Dutch journalist got to him 25 years ago. It was ignored then, and we put him up front in the augury to the first chapter. It's Dr. John Burton, an Australian, very distinguished academic, expert in conflict resolution. He's in his 90s and still going strong, still writing. And he's a very young head of the Australian Foreign Service, so-called permanent head. At the time of the Korean War broke out, and he disagreed with Prime Minister Menzies over getting involved in the war. And he advised against it. And when Menzies went in, he sort of took on leave of absence and finally resigned from the Foreign Service. But the Chinese invited him to come into China to look at the evidence of biological warfare. So he went in. And what he said about it was not that controversial. He just said that the Chinese firmly believe that there are biological warfare attacks. And created a bit of a storm. And Burton maintains that his successor as permanent head, who is a guy named Alan Watts, told him that as a result of the ruckus around this, he'd gone to the United States government and asked whether or not they'd use biological weapons in Korea, and that they had said yes, but only experimentally. And there's a credible third-hand witness that's sort of difficult to call a liar, but no one has picked up on that. No one picks up on it. Twice around, he's been put on the record, and no reviewer, no commentator has touched that, has gone anywhere near it. Yeah.